Okay. So thank you very much, Professor Maidash, for agreeing to sit down with us. As we've discussed ahead of time, this interview is mostly going to be discussing, or the theme of this interview is the development of replica symmetry breaking. But in order to get to that, we have some background questions. And the first one is, could you tell us a bit how first you got interested in physics and what led you to pursue a PhD in physics in solid state condensed matter physics?
Wow. I was born in New Jersey, and a small city called Bayonne. And in order to, we were not a wealthy family, but when I went to college in Philadelphia, I participated in a student working semester at the university taking courses, and then a semester in one of the many electronic laboratories in Philadelphia. This gave me money and this helped out a lot. After finishing three different laboratories of a now defunct corporation, I had a knowledge of semiconductor physics. I had also spent months on military engineering, and I decided that after I got my bachelor's, I would go to a laboratory in RCA. They're now defunct or they're taken over by General Electric. RCA gave me the possibilities to do advanced development. And my claim to fame, I have two claims to fame there. One is I invented or I produced, I built the first gallium arsenide transistor that had gain. And this is about 1960. And by making gallium arsenide diodes, I found the laser. I found a light emitting, a coherent source of light emission. I didn't know what it was then. My colleagues in advanced development did not know what it was then. The diode had a hole, it was a plateau. Around the plateau, light was streaming out if you bias it. Now you go to the supermarket and get the same effect. I missed it. I had no physics background to understand laser coherent light. So after that, it took me years to learn what I missed or what my colleagues had in development. So I decided that I would quit this advanced development engineering and go back to the university, which was in a place called Hoboken, New Jersey. And I did my PhD with a guy called Meissner, not the father Meissner, the son of the famous Meissner who was trying to make a career in the United States. And I did superconducting thin films and understood about critical currents, critical fields, et cetera. So this was very good. And then after the PhD, I decided to join a faculty in New York City. The faculty was called Fordham University, and we were building a group. There were maybe three or four of us, four. And it turned out that the physics department moving into the 70s was overexpanding. There would be effectively no chance of tenure. So I did not get tenure. And so I'm very happy about that in the 1970s. It's a small Catholic Jesuit university in the Bronx, New York. However, we had gotten a grant, or I had with a PhD student, gotten a grant of $5,000 and bought a mutual inductance bridge, which enabled me to do AC susceptibility at low temperatures, helium temperatures, at different frequencies with enormous sensitivities. And that is how we discovered, or we used the first time in the Physical Review, the term spin glass.
So before we get to that, I'd like to ask you a bit. So you mentioned, oh, sorry. You mentioned the collaborative group at Fordham, with, there was a Joe Dubnik, Mahendra Kawatra, Stanislaw Skalski. How collaborative was this environment for you to
the
get
collaboration jobs? Was the collaboration was very good. I guess three of us were tenure track. Joe Budnick was the senior professor who was also as a chairperson. And we were working very well. We were putting out a number of papers. And the university was in a crisis. The university was putting their money from the Bronx to Lincoln Center, Manhattan, where they would build a new campus at Lincoln Center, the law school, the social school, and perhaps even the religious areas. And so they wanted to curtail physics. Well, this happened to make the situation a bit difficult for the three of us. And it eventually, I was very lucky to get what they call a faculty fellowship. They give me half salary. So that somebody, the rest of the faculty takes over my teaching load with no extra expense. So they're saving money. And I had this full year faculty fellow was salary was, you know what the salary was in those days? Probably $8,000-$9,000 a year. And so I had enough to get me to go to London, to the Imperial College, to do superconductivity. But at the Imperial College, I met Brian Coles. And Brian Coles was commuting or had his contacts. I don't think he's at Cambridge, but I think he's Oxford. He's home Rothery. So he was going, had contacts with Sam Edwards and Phil Anderson, who was at Cambridge during the time. This is about 1970, 1972. Okay, so Phil Anderson was publishing papers, Cambridge, Bell Laboratories. And so under these discussions, we had already moved into alloys. We had already had a bunch of samples from Brookhaven Laboratory, where the Morsbauer people published Morsbauer experiments on things like gold iron, the whole concentration range. They gave us all these expensive gold samples, and we started to measure them in the AC. And so the situation, I was able to effectively get out. And my PhD student, Vince Canella, was able to get his PhD in 1971. He immediately got a postdoc in Wayne State University, Ford Laboratories, I guess, in Detroit. And he was continuing the measurements for his postdoc of 2 or 3 years. In 1972, we published the big paper. That was the physical review paper. And stumbling through the paper, we wanted to put the title Spin Glass Magnetic Ordering. The editor at the time, who was Joe, what's his name? He just passed away. Editor of Physical Review Letters forbade it. And so we got it into the abstract. So that's the whole start of this. It's interesting. There was this conference that came in 1972 that was sponsored by Wayne State. And lead speaker was Phil Anderson, of course, and he was using the word spin glass, but he didn't understand it at the time. And this was stimulated by our presentation of the data of a phase transition, a sharp phase transition that was field and concentration dependent and had a frequency dependence. That's the unique part in these alloys. So that's a long story short.
So that I better understand, right? Because you never embarked on a project to find spin glasses. Is that correct? I mean, if I look at Vince's thesis, there's no mention of spin glasses at all, for instance.
Okay. And we didn't use the word until I had my sabbatical or fellowship. It was September to December. I came back for Christmas. 4 months in the Imperial College. At Imperial was, I would talk to him every day, David Sherrington. There was my, Doniak was also there. Martin Zuckerman was there. Nick Rivier was there. A number of experimentalists were there. And I would go up the elevator with Brian Coles. And Brian Coles would say, spin glass, spin glass, spin glass. And so I picked it up. But I have to have a bit of, Brian Coles died in the low 70s, unfortunately, many years ago. Brian put out a paper, and the paper was on a system that didn't have local moments. He called it a spin glass. He was wrong. Well, everybody was wrong. So we did a good system, gold iron. We did copper manganese. We did a few other systems. And this, we, I think, proved that there was a phase transition. And you guys had to go and do some theory. You had to go define what a spin glass was. We used the term ferromagnet. It was indeed anti-ferromagnet. It has zero magnetism when you zero field cool. There's something more than that. And the other people, the long group of them, I think, Owen, people at a Ford laboratory, the industrial research, they were looking at similar alloys, but in too big a field. The field smeared out this delicate freezing process. When you put a big field on, you screw up the freezing.
So would it be fair to say that there was an experimental race to find a material that was a spin glass? No.
Okay. There was no experimental rage with these alloys, which were concentrated. The experimental rage was on the Kondo effect. They were going crazy for the Kondo effect. At Bell Laboratories, everybody was working on the Kondo effect. All these famous people, they even got Kondo to come over and explain to them what the Kondo effect. So people told us you're using too high concentrations. When you get the cusp in the susceptibility, your concentration is too high and you're destroying the Kondo effect. So this is the topic of great interest, the Kondo effect. You could look up all the Daybell and Steyerd. All these guys were doing Kondo, Kondo, Kondo. And Kondo was, you want a single impurity. I mean, this is a great many body physics from the condensed matter, but it's not a spin glass. So the initial reaction was not to bother with this. You're too high a concentration. You go to very low temperatures with single impurities. We defined them. We were the outlier.
So the immediate reaction then to your work was not intense. There was not. So how would you describe it then?
So the paper came out in 1972. Canella and Maidosh. And the paper was, the measurements were mostly done in New York. Canella continued it in Wayne State. I had left from my sabbatical 4 months. I had gone over to Germany now I have to speak German, the Forschungsanlage in Jülich. German's my second language, and unfortunately Dutch is my third language. But we have to keep them straight. In any sense, when I went to Jülich, I worked in the superconducting group. And I had the big institute leader, the German guy, a guy called Werner Buchel, said, oh, you want to do magnetism and superconductivity? You know magnetism will destroy superconductivity. So he said, do it, do it, do it. He gave me enormous support. And I threw out the 1970s, I guess we're talking about 1975, the spin glass problem burst. And who was in Jülich? Conrad Fischer and Kurt Binder. And these guys were constantly coming over to talk to me. So I had great theoretical support. I had the experiments running, had some visitors coming in, and they, but okay, we were doing things called giant moments, and it doesn't matter. This, the Jülich was a paradise. Turn four showings on Lager in Jülich. It was, had all the reactors there. They had powerful theoretical groups. Who is the guy? Okay, there is just theorists like Fried and Wagner, Herbert Wagner, who did the famous Heisenberg magnetism. You can't have it in lower dimension. All these guys were surrounding me as a young kid, and I was doing spin glasses.
And did you have students there as well, or?
I had enough visitors. I brought in some. Problem in Jülich was you didn't have PhD students. You would maybe bring in a student to do something called the Diplom Arbeit, a master's thesis. And this, we dabbled a bit with, and yeah, we were building some AC. Yeah, I was mainly, I would have a technician, but I wouldn't have a PhD. And that is the reason why we were leaving the Jülich. If you've ever been to Jülich, in between, you know it. It's now a major biological life laboratory. They closed the neutrons, but in any sense, they let the they effectively. It's too. You couldn't get any students. It's in a small village. And it became very constraining after 5 years. So I and my German wife at the time decided we wanted to go to a university. We had this prize. She was a computer programming expert. She worked on the big computers in Jülich. And so we thought we could get a university position. The spin glasses were a hot topic. I was probably giving an invited talk once a week. And I would go to London to visit Brian. We had a good Brian and his group. Yeah, okay. I guess Phil Anderson, Edwards and Anderson came out. Sherrington and Kirkpatrick. Sherrington went to IBM with Scott Kirkpatrick. And they wrote the book, I guess. John Hertz and Conrad Fisher wrote the first book. Peter Young and Kurt Binder had their, I think it's 1,000 citation review of modern physics. And then at a later stage came Giorgio Parisi.
So before we jump that, right, so you've mentioned the 1975 as really a landmark year with the Edwards Anderson and Sherrington Kirkpatrick models back to back. First, how closely were you following those, and what was your reaction to this? Did it matter to you as an experimentalist?
It did matter. Where did we put in? We used some of the susceptibility. We followed Anderson. We looked at how his susceptibility, where it follows Curie-Weiss, and then it drops with a cusp. I think we put that in one of our, at least in this conference proceedings, we had this. We were following them. Now, we didn't understand at the time the meaning of the replica symmetry breaking of the Edwards-Anderson order parameter. And we published some papers, of course, citing that. This got us into Sherrington-Kirkpatrick, which was the same year. We put out a physical review letter, I think it was 1976, maybe 76, 77, from Leiden, on Sherrington Kirkpatrick. We fit his phase diagram because we were able to tune the system from random to ferromagnet. And this was very rewarding for us. However, we were shocked when Sherrington and Kirkpatrick was deemed to be wrong. Okay, so you want to jump to Parisi?
No. Actually, I'd be curious how you said you were shocked when you found out it was wrong. Did you follow the discussion about this model, or you?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, we were following the discussion about the model. I didn't do the mathematics to understand. I did know the order parameter did not break replica symmetry. The order parameter was wrong. Okay, and although it was a beautiful statistical mechanical solution, I was dabbling in the statistical mechanics of the solution. And as far as an experimentalist gets, I even took statistical mechanics as a graduate. I even took a course in statistical physics. I was using, the different symmetries and the different, what is it called now? The different methods of statistical mechanics.
Okay.
And so we could fit. I had a good group running in a couple of PhD. I already made the jump to Leiden. That's the problem, where it's a different situation. But in any sense, maybe we can go back. But we were able to look at the solution, spent hours trying to learn it. The theorists in Leiden at the time were the very famous guys Mazur and Castellain. You have to know both of them are now dead. Castellain died very, these were very famous. I would go up and only in faculty meeting. They were on the upper level of the old Camerlingonis building, and they did not like experimentalists walking through their hollow halls. Any sense? This is very exciting because we have happily got a letter. They were not actively participating, both of them. Castellain was on the border of it. He was perhaps interpreting a little bit of Edwards Anderson. I don't think he got into Parisi, and that. This is 1976, 1977, 1978. In Leiden, having decided to move over from the big central Forschungs community in Jülich to Leiden. And Leiden was horribly traditional. Somebody had to open a window to let some fresh air in, and it was extremely painful for me, and it was a difficult time for me and my partner, my wife. I almost came to Duke in the 80s. I was interviewing at Duke. There was a very good group on superconductivity, on helium. Palmer was there. I don't know if he's passed away or
he's retired now. Yes,
he's retired now, but he's happy. So there was great statistical physics, and it was good low temperature. And I don't know really deep down why. I did not push the negotiations to fruition at Duke. Okay. So we were then going pretty wild into the spin glasses into the 1980s in Leiden. We presume it was I had suffered so much in Leiden, getting the group working and getting the language. It's very difficult. It's a different. They have French words, they have mostly English words, and they have German words. And so if you're a master of all three languages, you have no trouble with Dutch. Unfortunately, I only have two instead of French. So this is the part. Any sense, I'm saying, and this was, we decided to stay. Spin classes were going good. I had enormous support from the Dutch National Science Foundation. And my daughter was growing up speaking English, German, and Dutch. And we were, got over this barrier. It took me 5 years to build a group. It was painful, really painful. Go ahead.
So even coming in as a, because you were a full professor, you were not, you came in at the top of the heap at Leiden.
Wait a minute. No, this was the great problem. The Leiden system had something called professor, and then what they now call it associate professors, it was called lector. And I took over the chair of this famous condo guy by the name of Vandenberg. He found the condo effect, but he didn't know what it was, with another guy called de Haas. This is a long tradition of Dutch physics. So he had this chair, but he was not a full professor. But he would be able to have 5, 6, 7, 8 PhD students and 5, 6, 7, 8. And unfortunately, he was incompetent, but he built a new building and he retired. So they brought me in at his position, which was not a full, it was, call it an associate professorship with tenure.
Mm, I see.
Okay, but it was well supported and they had lots of money. So here I am 30 years later, sitting in my wonderful apartment, my office, my home office, looking out the window. And that is how we got into the spin glasses.
So let's backtrack a bit about the spin glass history. So you said in 1979, 1980, the Parisi brought the solution to the SK. And because you were following the field, you surely reacted to that. How did you react to the solution? Or how did you find out about Parisi's work in the first place?
We were always getting the literature. We had all the literature.
Okay. So mostly through
contact. I became an editor of the Physical Review Letters, but that was later. I had Parisi's Physical Review letter, I think it's 1979, and I did not understand it. Of course, okay, infinite number of order parameters. So you struggle with it, you think about it, you talk to people, you we, which were the theorists, maybe theorists in Amsterdam, I was very sociable then and had many conversations. The physical interpretation of Parisi was, for me, very difficult. Okay? And I had to eventually learn this, struggling through it, sit down for 3-4 hours with Parisi's man, then he had another paper, and then it was going. His original work came out of the, I think it's Frascati, the nuclear laboratory in Italy. But immediately after a few papers, he moved either to Saclay or to Paris, I think it was one of the Ecole Normale in Paris. I think this is 1980. So he was commuting. He wanted to get his chair at the Sapienza in Rome. But this took enormous, in Italy, everything goes rather slow. Okay, so you now have something called replica symmetry breaking. And for me and my group, we had a couple of PhD students. We were struggling. I don't think I got too much help from people like Castellane.
Or from David Sherrington or from the Brian Coles group.
I would go visit. David moved to Oxford. I lost contact. I had Conrad Fisher. The book came out in the late 80s, their book with John Hertz. Now, who did I guess some of the, yeah, I don't know. I struggled for years with replica symmetry breaking. And I knew then that Sherrington and Kapratik did not break replica symmetry breaking. And I was shocked. Looking back now is how stupid can you be? You see what the order parameter does from Sherrington and Kapratik, and you see that the entropy goes negative, everything breaks down. But we modeled it experimentally. We modeled their phase diagram from their famous physical review letter with a system called palladium iron manganese. Manganese makes it a spin glass, iron makes it a ferromagnet, and we tuned it by doing metallurgy, by doing different compounds, alloys. So this was a major, this was a struggle. Now into 1980s.
So in 1983, you wrote a piece for Europhysics News. When you write, and I quote here, that our ample possibilities exist for the practical applications of spin glasses, not only to in computer switching, memories, and layouts, but others. So you were pretty bullish on spin glasses at that point.
Yes.
So what was motivating your bullishness? So
you know that the spin-off getting into the 80s, we're getting mid-80s. We had then this neural networks. You had John Hopkins. And this opened a whole new area of uses of spin glasses. And so you can go over the traveling salesman problem. Scott Kapatrick.
Sure. But I'm asking more specifically on the material side. So
you had the polymers, heteropolymers, which had spin glass-like behaviors when you folded them. You had protein folding, which was the modeling of a protein.
Sure.
Protein involved something to do with spin glasses. You had biomolecules, which were also had aspects of spin glasses. You had, of course, the real glasses. Even look at Parisi today. He's doing real. You're doing real glasses, and I don't think that problem has been solved.
So what I'm trying to get at is, was it in your mind in 1983, was it already clear that spin glasses as a metallic alloy would have very limited technological applications, and that therefore it's the ideas that would be more important, or that took more time as a realization to emerge? That's what I'm trying to get at.
Okay, I would probably disagree. I when I went in looking at the magnetic alloy situation, we went from the transition metals, gold, iron, manganese. I could find out 30, 40, 50 of them. We went into the rare earths, lanthanum, gadolinium. We went even into things called the heavy fermions, strongly correlated metallic systems, which had a spin glass behavior. We went into superconductivity, which coexisted with spin glass. We had a vast repertoire of materials that were, I would almost say, typical classical spin glasses. They didn't involve anything like orientational molecules. They were systems. People are looking at something, what's it called? It's something called exchange bias, exchange coupling effects. A paper came out a week ago in Nature Physics, exchange bias between a coexisting antiferromagnet and a spin glass. These are the classical metallic or possibly insulate. All the insulators, the people in Jülich went into insulated chalcogenides. They went into the spin nails. I believe the spin glasses, but they're not applicable. The phenomenon of spin glass has been in the last 20 years or more materials related. It's all new material. That's what I tried to do when I wrote this. I was behest from Laura Green to write a review article in Reports on Progress in Physics. So reports, yes. And I concentrated on, I have a whole list of materials. And I get many citations, unfortunately, for materials. The theory has mainly been put into books. The guys in NYU wrote a book, Complexity in Spin Glasses, et cetera. Every now and then, a new theory comes out in the letters. But I would say if you look at Physical Review B or Journal of Physics Condensed Matter, there's every week, every month, another spin glass. So that is, but this is not what I mean. I mean that there's the spin-offs. This is the basic spin glass phenomenon, which I tried to give four criteria to measure and then to compare it with the theoretical models of how you do the J's as Gaussian or delta functions, et cetera. But there are all sorts of things. Evolutionary theory. We had a guy from the Ecole giving a talk on evolutionary theory and spin glasses about a year or two ago. Unfortunately, I forgot. You know all the guys at Ecole Normale. Nazar was there a few months ago. We had a wonderful dinner together. But he's doing, this is stock market valuation. Yes, you been playing the stock market?
So moving back to spin glasses, in your landmark 1993 book, right, which is a magnum opus in many respects, You write that experimental research on spin glasses largely ended in 1985. I mean, and as you were just arguing, there's still lots of work being done on spin glasses and as material. So what is the cusp? What's the difference between the two waves? Okay, fair enough.
In the book, I was wrong. I have to take that back. Okay. Nobody's perfect. What was happening, I was getting tired of the spin glass, the constant pressure, talks, meetings, conferences, conference proceedings. And my group in Leiden went into strongly correlated materials. And as I look back on my career, I've done three, I have to mention this, I made three contributions to physics over a 50-year period. Spin glasses, of course, is a major one. And I can see their contributions because the publications get over 1,000 citations. As I use that criteria and the spin glasses. I did something called the colossal magnetoresistance. The group went very important into that. That was a percolation problem of a semiconductor, which had a metal insulated transition. Okay, and now I'm spending the last efforts of my life on something called hidden order. Hidden Order is another phase transition. And this phase transition in a strongly correlated uranium compound, there are many, 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 many publications. The best condensed matter theorists have been working on it since 1985. It's still an unsolved problem. What's the order parameter? We were lucky, I guess, in the glasses, spin glasses, very lucky. Okay. Edwards and Anderson came along. Okay, you can modify that. Then you had Sherrington Kirkpatrick. Then you had Parisi. And then you went to the droplet model. There were terrific theorists. America likes the droplet model. I don't know how many people like replica symmetry breaking in the United States, but that's a funny point of it. That is, okay, so the hidden order problem is with all the modern techniques of neutrons and synchrotrons and USR, you name it, they can't find, it's a beautiful phase transition. The phase transition is remarkable, stable, second order. Specific heat has this enormous lambda point. It can't get an order parameter. So I've been busy. I just finished a review article with two famous theorists. Came out last year, February, March of last year, on the hidden order problem. Why is it hidden order? Because we don't know what it is. So that was why I turned away from the spin glasses for many years in the 83s, 85, into the 90s. I built a group doing uranium. We did some fantastic work at a laboratory, which is not the bomb making uranium. It's the deleted isotope. You can get this now if you have a special license. And we did a lot of work with rare earths and actinides, at least with uranium. And I put a lot of effort without the spin gland. A thing was probably in a PhD student about 1990, maybe 1995, 1990s, we found a heavy fermion compound that had a pseudo randomness that made it a spin glass. It was because of Ligand fields were random because of slight displacements of the Ligand component. They were creating some sort of a interaction, may have been modified rudiment could tell, but it didn't, it gave it a beautiful spin glass effect. And we published this, I don't know, 1995. So this took me back into the spin glasses. And then my last effort was with this Reports on Progress in Physics. That was 2014. And so I still try to follow it. I would like to really, I'm not going to solve the spin glass problem. I would like to solve the hidden order problem, which requires band structure. And if it's a whole new area, and the band, they don't know how to do the band structure for a hidden order phase. The best, all these famous guys in Rutgers and California, they don't know how to do it. So that's the end of my career.
So I'd like to talk about, since that book, you said you have kept abreast to some degree with the literature on spin glasses, on the experiments and on the theory. So how have you done this? Is it mostly through contacts or?
I read the literature now that I have the computer. I was editor of Physical Review Letters. So I would get an issue every week. And I would follow that up. I would have the library in Leiden is excellent. I would download Physical Review B, Physical Review Research, Physical Review Letters, and Journal of Physics Condensed Matter. And I scan through it, and I still keep up to date on it. and I hear occasionally lectures. When I retired, which was around 2002, 2003, I immediately went to the Max Planck Institute in Dresden. And at the Max Planck Institute, there were three big, there's the Institute for Complex Sustainment, that it probably you know, that's the big powerful theory institute. I guess Jülich at Mayo and Mercereau. Okay, but I went to the chemistry of, what's it called, Fiskof for Chemie. And I would hear per week, three, four, five, maybe every day I'd hear a lecture. I'd go from the physics department to Max Planck for Chemie. I would go then to Max Planck for complexity, and I would go to this other materials institute. So this kept me up, and I broke into some new areas. I did some new materials. I had a wonderful time in Dresden, although it's East Germany, and it's now very conservative. That was my, I eventually stopped traveling. I'm now quarantined. I'm now locked down and I have a curfew. So I can't do too much now, except talk to you here.
So as you've mentioned, right, there has been a differential in the reception to different ideas about spinning glasses in the US and in Europe, both in the experimental side and the theoretical side.
Yes.
You having bridged both communities, do you have any insight to provide or any perspective on what would explain that difference?
Now we're getting into culture. French culture is very different than German culture, which is, well, you probably know this, okay, which is very different from United States culture. Bell Labs was very famous. When User and Fisher came out with the droplet model, they were the greatest. It was immediately received in America. Now, I know little, I presume you guys then in Paris, when Risi came with the group, all the group at their Ecole, they were very, very, they got, but I don't know if they really talked to each other. Droplet model people, and there was the British people, Moore and who else?
Bray.
And Ray and Moore. I would think theoretically it's a cultural difference. But I mean your education and where you are. This gives you a different impulse to do the theory. How did Parisi, how do you think Parisi created in 1978-79, how did he think about replica symmetry breaking and apply it to a spin glass problem? You have to answer that one.
Well, that's
you're the theorist.
That's why we're building an archive.
Yeah, I would be interested in some of the other people. I can't answer this because of the, my problem is, yeah, I certain experimentalists, but that's less because experiment you have, you do a measurement and you have the data and you have then models or so, you are more in contact with hard material reality.
So
theory. But you know, you guys in, if you want, yeah. There were some great experiments done in Paris on the spin glasses and Saclay, there were great experiments. In Saclay, that still continues every now and then. There's another experiment coming out of the French room.
So that's what I wanted to bring you to talk about. So there's a difference also in the experimental side of spin glasses, I think, in the US and in Europe, right? The groups in Paris and you were working, while there's not that big of a response in the US, I think, if I'm not mistaken. So how do you interpret that distinction?
I don't know. Usually, people spend sabbaticals or postdocs in different countries, and they learn the culture. Now, who are the, since I don't really know, who are the, I have to go back to 2000, 20 years ago, who are the great experimentalists in spin glass in the United States? There's a group in Texas, there's a group in Minnesota. They're okay, they're doing waiting time of 10 to the 5 seconds. There's not too much new materials. Everybody is changing now high temperature superconductors, the oxides. Everybody is changing to the heavy fermions. Now it's the vile semi-metals or the black semi-metal and graphene. I don't think there's too much great experimental activity. What I would do, I have the program. It's going to be a big Zoom program of the March meeting of the American Physical Society. I have not yet gotten to a session on spin glasses. Possibly there would be one session. And this would be the Texas guy and Minnesota and some other little, maybe 2-3 talks. That's it. In the United States? Oh, but of course there are then the statistical mechanical prizes coming out. You would go to the computer simulations, Peter Young would get another prize. And Kurt Binder got a German prize. Okay, this is theory. There's still a vibrant theoretical prize winning. Experimentalists not.
So during your time at Leiden or elsewhere, did you ever get to teach materials on spin glasses and replica symmetry breaking in particular? I mean, because you wrote the book, right? Then you have a section on this. Yeah. Did you ever use that in a pedagogical context?
No, not in a formal course, in little seminars. For me, the replica symmetry breaking, infinite number of order parameters. Replica symmetry breaking, which I've used 10, 20 times with the students or maybe in talks, is the multi-valley landscape. That's it. I'm so simple-minded. With that picture, I can talk 15 minutes about spin glasses. That's replica symmetry. That's the beauty. That took me to get that picture. I think it's in my book. To get that picture out of Parisi, I think that's fantastic. That's fantastic. We had this guy, I wish I knew his name, 2 years ago from the Ecole. He was doing evolution theory.
It can be many people. That's why. It could be Giulio Biroli. It could be a number of his collaborators.
I have to go back on a computer. I could find out 3 years ago who gave an Ehrenfest colloquium on a Wednesday evening from the Echo. And in his talk, he was using spin glasses. And it was the multi-valley landscape. Isn't that beautiful? Isn't that beautiful? That's it. In a multi, I'm just looking. Do I have a multi-valley landscape here? And yeah, here I have a multi-valley landscape somewhere
yes.
down there here.
Yes.
That's it. That's so, I've been using this picture for the last 20, 30 years.
Is there okay. is there anything else that I've missed out that you would like to share with us about that era?
It was great, good. I wanted to stop when I went to, in 1990, I worked on the random field problem when I went to Santa Barbara, 1985. 1990, I left the family and the kid, my daughter, and partner back in Leiden, and I moved to Santa Barbara. Santa Barbara is great. Vince Giacarino was my host. He's one of my mentors. Lucky I had four mentors. Vince helped me. I had this apartment. I could take the bike. And I would get up 7 o'clock in the morning and write. And I, September, probably October, November, December, took a break at Christmas, January, February, March, April, May, and June, and I had finished most of the book of this atmosphere. And I had the Institute for Theoretical Physics. I had a bunch of experimental talks. They were great. The great physics department, but it was beautiful weather. I was at the beach. And I don't now, looking back, how I could devote a year's time of 9 months, I guess, 10 months, writing a book, writing every day. It took, that's how the book came out. My goodness, I can't do that now. So that's my experience is but I was calling up the university. We made, during the writing, we made the big breakthrough in this hidden order problem. So the group was doing hidden order on uranium, strongly correlated. I was writing with 6,000 mile separation. I was in Santa Barbara. The group was running in Leiden. So I'm pretty happy.
So the last question I have is about the materials, right? Do you still have notes, papers, correspondence from that epoch? And if you do you have a plan to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
What do you mean how I made these alloys?
No, I mean the physical correspondence and papers and notes and not the materials themselves, but the material, the archival
materials. Letters going back and forth.
Yes. Or your notes.
Notes. I will go, if they let me in, I will go into probably, not tomorrow, but Thursday, I go into my office. They gave me a very nice office. I have surround, it's a mess. I have books all over. But when people walk into my office, they laugh at me. They point and they say, have you ever heard being paper free? And I probably could find some of the letters. Now, what would you suggest? A letter to David Sherrington. I went over to visit David Sherrington 2 years, 1.5 years ago at Oxford. And we had a very, very nice chat. And he, of course, he's an old dear friend. That is, and I probably could, but we were such happy kids in Imperial College, and this would be around 72, 73, 70, at least before he stayed a number of years. He went to IBM, and then Doniak was there, went to Stanford, and Zuckerman went to
McGill.
I'll take a look. And if I can do the, there's a mass of people.
So take a look. What I encourage you.
A letter from Phil Anderson telling me Okay, I don't think Phil has, I don't think I ever corresponded with Phil. We had dinner a couple of times in Aspen, but since he just passed away, yeah.
Or with Brian Coles, for instance. And honestly.
Brian Coles, interestingly, Brian is really a sharp guy. He was this intensive, collaborative, sharing effort of the Brits between Oxford, Cambridge, and Imperial, this triangle of, and even some of the little schools. I went here to Birkbeck. I took courses on critical phenomenon. I went to here mathematical physics from, is it David Edwards and Peter Wolfhard? Peter Wolfhard, that's Spin Glasses. He was, all these guys, the sphere in Imperial in was excellent. Excellent. Maybe I could find some of the it was the idea. It was Ryan Coles got Neville Mott at Taylor and Francis to ask me to write the book. Brian did not want to write the book himself. He could very well have done it. Brian was moving into administrative positions higher up as dean at Imperial and presumably much higher. And he got himself into a lot of political trouble in his deanship. That's besides the point. He said, do the book. And we give you $1,000, live it well in Santa Barbara. Go and do it. And yeah. However, they misspelled Taylor and Francis on the book's cover. They wrote the book's cover about me, about the Spin Glasses. Three misspellings.
Getting back to the archive, I strongly encourage you, honestly, all correspondence of your scientific production would be of interest. I don't know if the University of Leiden has a rare manuscript department. They probably do. You could talk to them about...
They have a great archive, but they're not interested in me. They're interested in the Haas and Shubnikov. The archives are the exchange of letters between Moscow and Shubnikov and the Haas. Shubnikov, of course, got himself shot at a young age when he was doing too much traveling. The Haas collaborated with the Germans and they took away his professorship. So these are very important archives. Nothing like this has happened to me.
Nonetheless encourage you to contact them.
Yes. Okay, let us see. Thank you for spending this long time with me. I hope I've shed some light on the replica symmetry breaking, which is part of my career. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Okay.